Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting
situation right now. Hi there, I'm Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and I am known as Carol the Coach, and this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. This show is about strength, hope, and recovery. And you know that it is so important when you're dealing with sexual addiction to have a really solid plan for how you're going to stay on target. This stuff is hard. There is no doubt that so many people do some of the stuff that they need to do to get better. And then, as a result, they forget that they really need to implement from all areas of their life. You know, they may need a sponsor, they may need a 12-step group, they may need a certified sexual addictions therapist. They mean and want so badly to get healthy, and they don't know that they have to do their reading every day. And I'll tell you what, tonight we're going to have Michael Dineen on, and he has written The Gift of Fulfillment, Living the Principles of Healthy Recovery. And it's an amazing book that is a narrative about his life, how he found recovery, and what he believes are the principles for healthy recovery. So I want you to stay tuned. You'll really enjoy him. I mean, he is amazing. This book is so well written. It's so easy to read. And he's coming on about 9:15. So we're going to look forward to talking with him. And most of you know this show. You know, you can call me anytime at 646-595-3284 and get the help that you need by calling in anonymously and asking the questions that you've wanted to ask but were afraid to talk with your doctor about. You were afraid to share it with your wife or husband. You didn't know if your best friend would understand, your minister, your pastor, your priest, or your rabbi. There is so much shame that's attached to sexual addiction that I got to tell you, this is a very safe place to ask your questions, to send me emails to carolthecoach@aol.com, and to make a difference in your very own life by following a recovery plan that works for you. And if you think you're stronger than the addict, I got to tell you, you are not. None of us are stronger than the addicts that are within us. But our committee, as Patrick Carnes says, our committee, when we've got sponsors and we've got 12-step groups and we have home meetings and we have friends and we have good therapists and loving support people, all that put together can definitely help you to stay connected to the recovery plan that you need to get clean. Now, so many of you know that I work with men and women alike. I work with their partners, and I work with group therapy with sex addicts. And this is by far the hardest addiction to find recovery in part because sex is all around you. There is no doubt about it. Sex is everywhere. And so it's so important to know how to handle the tough situations. What do you do when it's summer and it looks like everybody is wearing short shorts and mini skirts and bathing suits? How do you handle that? You can't be blind, so what do you do? Well, very clearly, there's a lot of different suggestions that we as therapists make that are made in your 12-step groups that don't take away the temptation, but they help you to navigate around it. For instance, one of the things that you can do is called the 3-second rule, although my guys like to call it the 1-second rule. And that is, when you see somebody who's wearing a low-cut shirt, when you're looking at someone who's wearing short shorts, when you see a bare-chested man, you notice what's going on, you immediately divert your eyes to someplace else, you think a pure or healthy thought, maybe you think of your family, your puppy, you know, you're paddle boarding, you're canoeing, maybe you think of a project at work. You train the brain to think about something else. So what does that do? That may sound silly and simple, but what it does is it deactivates the reward center. And the reward center is that part of your brain that lights up whenever you have a sexual thought, whenever you have a sexual vision. And so that's why it's so important to know what you can do to make it better. And if you don't quite feel comfortable talking to a therapist who's certified in sexual addictions, or maybe, you know, you've been dying to talk to your pastor, but you're afraid that he or she won't understand, then get some of the important books on sexual addiction. You'll learn all sorts of tools there. You know, whether it's SA or SAA, the book, you can get on the websites and order those books. You can go to meetings whereby you get the books. You can get Out of the Shadows by Patrick Carnes, Facing the Shadows, the workbook. You can get The Gift of Fulfillment, Living the Principles of Healthy Recovery. I mean, it matters not what you get in that. I really believe a spiritual concept is if you're getting a book that deals with your topic, you're going to be able to extract things that you absolutely need to know. So that's what I'm sharing with you tonight, that, you know, bibliotherapy can be very, very powerful. Now, I know you may be worried, oh, I don't want to bring that kind of book into the house. My wife will see it. My husband will see it. My best friend will see it. My in-law will see it. Well, then find a very sacred space that no one would ever be able to find. Maybe it's the trunk of your car. Maybe it's a large lockbox. And keep everything there. Because I do agree that an inquisitive spouse might look up and see the work that you're doing in a book. And that work is yours. That's private. If you want to share it with them, I'd talk to your sponsor about that or your therapist about that. But clearly, your work is your work, and you don't have to feel guilty about keeping that to yourself. I know it gets very confusing because all your life you have been hiding your sexual addiction. We call it lying by omission. Oh, maybe you've actually lied to him or her. And so here I am telling you that you have the right to do your work and not share that with anybody. As a matter of fact, there's a principle that says if it's going to hurt somebody, you really have to decide, is it something that you want to come clean about? This business is so tough, and I'll tell you why. Because so many of us therapists that believe in a very safe, supportive place, you can talk to your partner about your sexual addiction. You can share about the many affairs, the prostitution, the massage parlors, the anonymous sex that you've had, the pornography you've viewed. However, that is in a guided situation with somebody who knows how to handle that situation. If you just share that stuff with your partner or spouse, oftentimes that can devastate him or her. You know, I was just talking to a man tonight who said, my wife experiences so much post-traumatic stress. Post-traumatic stress because she can't go down the street and not wonder, was I with her at that restaurant? She can't go to a movie and wonder what movies I took this person to. And so that's where you really have to weigh things. You have to have a supportive place. And, you know, within the 12-step community, there's a lot of people that believe if it's going to hurt somebody, share it with your sponsor. Get it out of you. But you may want to think about what kind of devastation that may affect your spouse or loved one. You know, that's why don't try to figure this out on your own. This is tough stuff. This is tough for a therapist. It's tough for a sponsor. But together, we can all brainstorm and figure out what is the right thing for you. Okay. Now, I had an email the other day, and I had read part of it to you. And this is from a man named Tom. And he says, I see sex addiction recovery as much more than abstinence from unhealthy sexual obsessions and compulsions. It's really about transforming and living a full and productive life. Oh, he is really right about that. It is from this state that the recovery, occurs. I wish the motivation to change and grow would shift from fear to compassionate curiosity. I would like to live from a place of love and compassion. Yet even though I can write this, I am in much internal fear and anxiety, discomfort, and I feel that the blood pulses stronger through my stomach. I'm always on guard. There's so much anxiety, and it's no way to live. I think my deepest terror is that I will live an impoverished life and not know the feeling of love, both giving and receiving it. Can you help? Well, there's no doubt, Tom, that you are very insightful. You already know the pain that you're feeling and the pain that's been inflicted on your loved ones. Awareness is always the first step, but you've got to figure out what support is available. So listen tonight to The Gift of Fulfillment, Living the Principles of Healthy Recovery by Michael Dineen, who is a licensed and certified social worker. He is a certified addictions counselor, and he's been in long-term recovery for over 20 years. This man has lived the life that many of you have lived, and he knew what to do to get through it. He had some insight and some enlightenment, and I'm just so excited to be talking with him tonight because he has a lot of insight, and I'm sure that he can be very helpful to you and to partners who might also be listening. So, Michael, This is Carol Sheets, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. Boy, this book is excellent. I mean, it is such a fast read because as you're reading it, you're thinking, oh, my gosh, this is the addict's life. You did a beautiful job.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
100%. And, you know, you have worked in recovery for a long time. You're program manager for the Center for Dependency, Addiction, and Rehabilitation at the University of Colorado Hospital. You're a certified addictions counselor, and you've been in long-term recovery for over 20 years. So I applaud you for all your hard work. And it is hard work, isn't it?
It's very hard work. And I do want to acknowledge that was I just listened to you for the past 15 minutes. It was amazing. I thought everything you said was great. And that letter from Tom was just beautiful because that's exactly, as we get into it, you'll see that this is exactly what the book is about, is that finding that higher meaning and finding out what it's like to truly love for the first time ourselves, have intimacy with God as well as others, and really feel satisfied and fulfilled, which is something I think most of us in recovery really struggled with, is just feeling like we were missing out or feeling like the like we always wanted more of whatever it was, especially the lust, which was never satisfied. So that was just a beautiful letter where he's seeking and his heart is open. So it sounds like he's well on his way, seeing that there's deeper meaning to this addiction, that in the long term it's a gift.
Boy, and that is absolutely true, but when people are in such despair, it's hard to believe that it is a gift and it will become a gift. So now tell me a little bit about where did you get the idea for the book and how did your journey get started?
Sure. So the idea for the book, we do workshops here at Cedar, like any 12-step facility that deals with co-occurring disorders. We have people in their first 90 days of recovery, and it's a teaching hospital that I work at, University of Colorado Hospital. So we always have doctors, students, nursing students, pharmacy students sitting in on our lectures and workshops. Not the actual therapy, not the individual therapy or the group sessions, but one of the sessions I was doing on the fourth step was really looking at what was underneath addiction, when you look at the resentments and the insecurity and the fear and the character defects and the secrets and the insanity and all the compulsions that we have to sort of look at when we get into the fourth step, as well as the assets, because that whole theory of God doesn't make junk is very true. And I was giving a talk about how we don't need to really get into a whole lot of shame around this work or pride, because it was really just like wiping the mud off a window so that we could see clearly that we were getting rid of the things inside of us that were blocking us from the sunlight of the Spirit, where they were blocking us from being able to have authentic, positive emotions towards ourselves and to feel free. And some nursing students were listening and approached me afterwards and told me that basically what I was saying throughout the whole hour and a half and what I was teaching these addicts was exactly what anybody could benefit from, that everybody has that void that I was talking about, and everybody struggles. They didn't really understand the addictive process of how that can become a complete beast in and of itself. But that's where the idea came from, was these nursing students who said that, you know, that could you get something down on paper that could help anybody? And so I had always separated out the addict from the non-addict, the normies and earth people, and, you know, had different names. And I really was able to see over time that the addict, when it comes to sex addiction especially, it's, you know, everybody has their obsessions. Some people it's money or fame or fortune or connections or exercise or food, and some people have chemical addictions, people addictions, codependency, and some people it's sex, it's lust. And um, so so that everybody's filling that void. And so the book is really addressing anybody with a problem that can really see that, yeah, I don't feel the way I want to feel. My relationships are not where I want them to be. There are things in my life that I need to improve, or I have everything I want, and it seems like I have the wife, I have the kids, I have the job, and it's the recipe everybody told me would be the recipe for success, and I still feel the void. So the book was, the idea of the book came from these nursing students. And then when going through the CSAT process with Carnes, he had told me I should probably start writing. And he took us through an exercise of one of his books, the Out of the Recovery Zone. He took us through a legacy focus, lifetime at a glance assignment that you can give in your outpatient, and or people could do even if they just bought his book. And there's sections in it, like achievements and legacies and experiences and relationships and goals, and what has your life been like to date, and then also looking at the future. Even though it's one day at a time, one moment at a time, we still need to have a vision and a mission for our future so that we can start to live that out. We can lodge that into the unconscious, but also to see when jobs come or opportunities come and we're able to balance that off, does that match my value system? Does that match the goals that I'm seeking? Is that part of my mission? Is that part of my vision? And so that we're taking a direction. We never know quite where God's going to lead us or where life's going to lead us, but at least we have a path that we're walking. And so I wanted to get more exposure. Other than the hospital, I wanted to reach a broader audience, especially about sex addiction. I feel like God's given me a huge gift in that I'm in long-term recovery from sexual addiction, and like you said, this is the most difficult. So I feel like there's more people to reach than just the people that pay the money to come to this hospital. And this was an avenue that came out of that visioning process that maybe I should write a book, and that could broaden my platform and be able to speak more to this issue and to start normalizing it in society, to show people that this is out there, it's real, it's treatable, there's a ton of hope, and you can get to the right person like yourself to get in touch with someone. I don't know where you're based out of, Carol, but you sound like an amazing therapist, life coach. I would certainly refer to you, and I will. I do a lot of that with patients that leave, because it's just after 30 days, you're not fixed. This is a lifetime deal. So you're just getting started after you get through treatment, and then you need to plug in, like you said, to the home groups, to the sponsor, to a good life coach and therapist, and wherever there's a positive community, because this is a disease. Sex addiction is really an illness that really wants us alone. And it wants us isolated, and it wants us in our head, like the committee you talked about. It wants us dead, ultimately. It wants us miserable, and it wants us to really think in terms of, well, it's my life anyway, and who am I hurting, or it's my choice. And it distorts everything that goes through our brain. It distorts everything good about life is what lust and sex addiction, it robs us of. So this is a... this is our message. It sounds like your message and my message are identical. It takes a team, but a beautiful life can emerge for a gentleman like Tom, who is seeking more than just the reduction of wanting to act out sexually, which it was profound the way
he's
wanting a full life.
Yeah,
exactly. He's wanting something. He's wanting, which was remarkable, because he wasn't talking about money or climbing Everest, which are great things. People can go out and chase whatever dream they want, but what he was talking about in his letter was, I want to be able to love. I want to be able to experience true intimacy. And talk about something that robs us of the ability to love, and that's addiction, especially sexual addiction. That it bypasses everything meaningful. It goes to the intrigue and the forbidden and the tease and the right now and the getting our needs met, and it bypasses everything that love presents. So For instance, I remember a few years back, like 5 years ago, I was sitting with my daughter eating some noodles at a restaurant, and I just had this blast of gratitude just rip through my body just to be with this little girl, enjoying her company, eating noodles. Well, I wasn't capable of having these feelings on a daily basis. I needed some major high in my life, something dangerous or in some crazy relationship or seeking out something that was ultimately would leave me hungover and more full of more shame and more guilt and needing to escape more just to escape the uncomfortable feelings. But to be able to just the way you talked about the brain repairing itself through the 1 second rule and then not giving it rewards, for the brain to be able to heal and the heart and the soul to be able to heal to a point where just holding hands with my daughter walking down the street can bring me to tears on a daily basis, where I feel just so grateful. And I think it almost surpasses what people that don't have addictions, that they have no idea how special this is to feel love and to be able to have integrity and show up. And I've been, you know, faithful to their mother for our 12-year marriage, and to be able to walk these things out, it's such a gift. So that's really, the book is a compilation of all that. It's my life. It's people that I've counseled. It's men that I've sponsored. It's a lot about my sponsors and people like you, Carol, that have come into my life, even for short periods of time, or have written books. Like you said, somehow that there's bibliotherapy. I've had many men in particular, they seem to be sometimes Christian mystics like Anthony DeMello and Thomas Merton and Henry Nouwen that have really helped my recovery journey and helped me as a therapist. And they're just talking about, in the way they were sponsors, they're actually just talking about the soul journey, the person's our spiritual journey, but I could apply it to my life. So I do think books are useful in that sense, that someone can understand us and not know every little detail about our life and show that this is a human condition, and then help guide us to that next step. Like someone like Tom, he has that desire for a new life, but like you said, he doesn't know just the next step, and the next step is probably to get to a meeting, to get to that therapist, to buy the book, and to move and to open the heart up. It's real simple. It's not easy, but it's a simple process to get started. Scary, very scary. Like even just looking away, like you talked about the 1 second rule. Just looking away can actually bring up feelings of, I feel like I'm going to die. I feel like I'm actually going to die if I don't take that next look, if I don't drive down that street, if I don't look at that next porn site, or if I don't get away and get in the car and start cruising, or whatever the behavior is, if I don't check out that new massage parlor or whatever the triggers are. It doesn't really matter necessarily what the rituals or the triggers of the actually acting out experience is. Sometimes it does if it's illegal. What matters is the surrender process that it takes to ignite the recovery process, and it's scary. It feels like a tidal wave just nails you out of the blue, and that you're not going to survive unless you actually do the behavior that's going to finally relieve you of the obsession or run from it somehow, or there's just a feeling of, I may lose my life here if I don't act out. And it's not true, but the disease makes us believe it's true. So the taking it a step further from the 1 second rule is, if I die in this moment, not lusting or not looking or not acting out in some way, so be it. At least I die with integrity, and at least I die knowing that I was trying to be a better man or a better woman. And it sounds dramatic, but that's what it's like in the first year of recovery. It really is. It feels like life and death moment to moment. And so,
well, and I know in our training, and you absolutely know this too, that, you know, to feel that urge or that craving or that feeling and that, but I've got to, and to just kind of go with it and not do anything with it, it will eventually pass. And that saying,
right,
this too shall pass, really does work. But oftentimes when that feeling comes, it is conditioned our clients to absolutely believe they have to do something with it. And you don't. If you just sit with it, if if you just read a page of recovery material, if you just dial that phone, if you just get in the car to head to that meeting, it may be all it takes to divert it. Not always. You know, I've had
That's
people
right.
that said, I was heading to a meeting and I saw somebody who was sweeping the floors up and we ended up in the closet. I mean, we both know that it's not an absolute, but when you do the next right thing, it usually makes a huge difference.
Right. And you're in the right place at the right time. When you're not, when you're just taking the next right action, you'll find that instead of ending up in the closet, many times a person walks out of the closet that you knew, that you met at a recovery meeting, that you just, you needed to see in that moment. It's amazing that instead of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, but you're, somehow your brain realizes, it's like self-efficacy. It realizes eventually that, wow, I am going to live, even though it feels overwhelming in this moment. I'm not only going to live, I'm going to be grateful that I waited to act out, and that I called somebody, and that I postponed, and that I walked through it. Because it really, I mean, I used to get very annoyed by especially lay therapists that didn't understand addiction, that weren't addicts themselves, with this whole instant gratification versus long-term gratification piece. And it can be reduced sometimes to that kind of simplicity, that in order to find happiness, like Viktor Frankl, the Jewish psychiatrist that survived Auschwitz, he said, success like happiness cannot be pursued. It must ensue as an unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a cause greater than oneself. He's basically saying that happiness is a byproduct of right living, and that you can't, you can't go for happiness and find it. It happens to you. Happiness actually is a gift that just happens because you're living a certain way. And so the addict eventually starts to realize, if I get put through this pain, if I walk through this pain right now, the long-term gratification is I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have peace in my heart. I'm going to wake up and I'm going to like who I am. I'm going to be able to help people with my experience, strength, and hope. I'm going to get inspired. I'm going to be excited about life, about challenges that are in front of me. It's an amazing life that emerges by just giving up the short-term gratification of relieving those uncomfortable feelings. Because really, sex addiction is not, as we know, really not about sex. Like that gentleman was talking about when I cruise into these towns and he's on the road for 6 months, and he needed to, that the minute someone shows any interest or that he's conquered it, he's out the door. It's like you got to the point that it's not really about the sex. There's deeper issues here. And really, it is. There's these issues of resentment, these fears, trauma from our youth, abandonment issues, self-esteem, co-occurring disorders like depression, all that stuff. They're treatable, and they're not the monsters that people think that they're running from. They're constantly running towards the addiction for fear of the unknown. But once we start walking through the unknown, we're like, really? That's what I've been running from my whole life? These uncomfortable feelings that once I embrace them and get the right help, I can move past, and it's not half as scary as people think.
So tell me a little bit, Michael, about your own recovery, because obviously you shared what made you write the book, and it was really to help students, interns, and other people understand the concepts that you were talking about and doing in your workshops.
Right.
And teaching. But how did you get involved in recovery?
So I came in through, I went to my undergrad at Boston College, and I was a full-blown sex addict and alcoholic from my teenage years, where I was just, it was almost as if I had found, it was almost a gift from God. I grew up in New York, Irish Catholic kid, and the minute I drank alcohol and put chemicals in my body, I felt like I had come home, and girls were it really was an obsession from day one, where I would get drunk, and then I'd have liquid courage, and then I would try to act out with different women, and it became something that all the other guys thought was an incredible skill, and I was wondering why other people weren't doing the things I was doing, the amount I was doing them, but I couldn't stop. I would want to go out every night once I got to college. I was in college from 86 to 90, and when I got out, I started working for a company called EMC, which was a computer company. I was completely lost. I was making a bunch of money, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. I wasn't money motivated. I didn't really even enjoy computers at the time or anything. I just ended up in this job because I was lost, and I didn't think about these things. I didn't think enough about myself to have goals and dreams and aspirations. I was empty, and I'd never shared about the shame and guilt that I was walking around with every day, and so I'd never had an intimate conversation in my life. I was 23 years old, and I'll spare you all the details, but I was in Boston. I ended up going to a Portuguese fest, disappeared from work, got into a bottle broken over my face, stitched up, crazy story, ended up on a boat, a large ferry boat with a bunch of drunken idiot friends of mine going out to a party on Nantucket Island off Cape Cod. And as we were coming into the harbor, I decided I was going to jump off the boat after having a few drinks. And this is one of those ships that has 150 cars underneath it. It's not a small little ferry boat. So after I jumped, I was super insecure about my body. So I left my shirt on, kicked my shoes off, threw my wallet on the table, jumped up on the top rail, jumped off, ended up eventually getting to shore. When the cuffs were put on me, they asked me if I was suicidal, and I said, I think I'm just impatient. And that's what I thought at the time. I didn't even think enough about my life to really care enough that they were all amazed. I was on the front page of the Nantucket Times. They didn't know how I didn't get sort of swept under and that I survived. So, but again, like most addicts, I wasn't scared of dying. I was scared of living. And so I was in a hotel room the night before my court date. It's August 4th, 1991, Sunday night. I had done my typical sex addict thing. I'd gone to a bar and met some women and asked them to come back to the hotel room and drink with us. And I was with this woman, and we were engaging each other. And I ended up I said something rude to her. She said something rude to me, like, you're a whatever. And she ended up in bed with a friend of mine that I was just staring at the ceiling going, I have no idea what normal people do on Sunday evenings, but they're definitely not watching this and listening to this craziness go on and going to court and missing work for ferry jumping with a sunburn and stitches in my head from a bottle and just on and on. I just knew something needed to change, and there's something wrong inside of me. And so the next day, going down Route 9 in Boston, and again, I'm sunburned, I'm scared. We had the top blown off the roof of the Jeep, so I was shivering in this Jeep, and I had a moment of grace, a moment of desperation that changed my life. I had like a Bill Wilson experience. As we were rolling down this Route 9, I started praying for the first time in my whole life, for real, like as a little Irish Catholic kid, you know, the Hail Mary full of grace, help me find a parking space type, where I'd say things like, you know, if you get me out of this, I promise I'll be a good boy. We have a saint for everything. So I would pray to St. Jude, get me out of jail or whatever. And I hope that, you know, and I'd have this picture of St. Jude going to God saying, listen, I can't tell you this kid's name, but we need to help him out. Because I thought if I prayed and God knew I was there, he would kill me. I had a really distorted view of God as well. But so I hit this emotional bottom. I didn't care if I lived or died. I was terrified, and I just prayed with my heart. I just said, help, help me. I can't stop doing, can't stop womanizing. I can't stop drinking. I can't imagine my life not doing this, because I thought, you know, I'm 23, the fun will be over, but I can't imagine my life continuing to do this. I was terrified. And I said this prayer in my heart. I just said, help me. And my whole body got warm, and I knew something had shifted in my consciousness, and I knew that I was going to get help. And so that was the day, that was August 5th, 1991, and August 6th is when I went to my first 12-step meeting and called my sister up crying.
Now, can I just interrupt you for 1 minute? Because
yeah.
Clearly, for our listening audience, I got to tell you that Michael just almost verbatim described what happened to him as he did in his book. So if you've ever come close to that same situation, or maybe you've been there just as Michael had, that is the point for some people where they go, not only do I need to make my life different, but it's almost that knowing, as you said, that you're on the uphill now. You know that it's like you've accessed your higher power and something's come over you and you know you're going to get help.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I didn't
so
care.
Continue.
Yeah, and in that moment, you're right. In that moment, I didn't care if I lost my job or if I would ever have another girlfriend in my life or if I was going to be exposed and people were going to humiliate me. Nothing mattered in that moment. I knew I would do whatever it took. And again, it's sometimes people are looking for that big burning bush experience or that huge cathartic moment. And sometimes the cathartic moment is just being desperate enough to call you up, Carol, and say, can I make an appointment and can you just tell me what to do next? Is the beginning of the journey. So it doesn't have to be this major, it could be. But I think those experiences happen less than the educational variety and that hitting that bottom and taking that next step. Because when you hit a true bottom, you're going to follow it up with action in most cases. You're going to follow it up with some form of action, and usually that action is asking for help. And if someone has that, you know, it's always BS after the but, if they have this experience where I know I've changed and things are going to be different, but I can do this on my own, when they start talking in terms of I can do it on my own or I know what I need to do this time, I just need to do it, that's when you know you're in trouble. Because it's that same brain, it's that same committee that is hijacking and saying, okay, I got you again, because you're actually listening to yourself again, which is not what you should be doing in early recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what started my journey, and it's been messy the last 22 years. It's the most, I wouldn't trade it in for anything. I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life. In fact, coming over here, I was just in this mood of just grateful that I was going to be talking to you, and I took the kids to the pool tonight and kissed my wife as I was leaving, and things aren't perfect and we hurt each other's feelings, and I go through what I go through here in my work setting, but it's just, you know, camping this weekend and wanting to be there and not needing to be the center of attention and just enjoying sitting around a campfire with friends and watching how excited the kids get, you know, the headlamps on, and just all these things that have come to me as a result of recovery. Everything good in my life, everything, my master's degrees, my certification in spiritual direction, the CSAT, so all the certificates, the CMAT, all those things that have come to me, the traveling around the world, all these things, every single bit of it has been birthed out of recovery, almost directly. Even my wife was literally given to me. I was 12-stepping a guy up in Estes Park, Colorado, and I was trying to get him to get back on his meds for his bipolar disorder. And my wife literally walked up, and she was in between. She was taking groups of people down to Mexico at the time in her life. They were building houses, and they'd come back and raise money and go down and help. And she was living in Estes Park waiting tables, and she walked right up to the table. She was gorgeous, and I thought, this woman is not going to want to have anything to do with me. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't act out in any way. I'm into recovery. I'm not fun. I like to kayak and hike and do a couple of things, but I'm not the kind of guy this woman would be interested in. And she turns out to be my wife. So direct correlation right to recovery, just trying to stay sober and try to love people and try to be there for other people other than myself. And my wife gets dropped in my lap. I know what that sounds like. Oh, really? You know, go help somebody, and some beautiful woman's going to walk into your life. But when we're ready, and we're not looking for it, and we're living this life of recovery, these things happen. I have countless stories of my friends and myself to say that there isn't any coincidences, that these things are happening all over. It's just we haven't been aware of them because our eyes haven't been open, because we're tunnel visioned on ourselves or the disease process. We're not living in the solution. So the last 20 years have really 22 years have it's been a lot about growing up. Like the book talks, it sort of goes in phases. At first, it's really about giving up. So that first few years, I heard one guy say, you know, my first 5 years of recovery, I was always thinking about how crazy I was. And then the next 15 years of recovery, I realized how crazy I am. So the first phase of this recovery is about giving up. And then it's about cleaning up. It's about cleaning up our heart and our mind. And then it's about making up, really. It's about going out to others and repairing the damage and being able to hold our head high wherever we walk. I can go back to New York and not be scared who's going to see me, what woman that I acted out with is going to expose me in front of my wife and kids or whatever. To go back and to be able to make amends and to make things, to do the best I could do to make everything right in my life with the world. And then really the last few steps, the principles of the 12 steps is about growing up. It's about learning how to say I'm wrong and I'm sorry. It's learning about how to be kind to ourselves and pray and meditate and think of others in a healthy way and to live for something larger than myself. To hope that there's be somebody listening tonight, that if we can help one person take that next right step, then that's what we're doing here tonight. So to live for something larger, like Frankel was saying, that it's not about me. And to go through that process over and over again, I get to go through it every time I take somebody through the steps. Every time I go to a meeting, I get reminded of, oh yeah, this is who I am. And I'm an addict and I could be back there in a millisecond, and to learn how to have empathy and compassion for other people. We really need to engage a community to do that and make a commitment to a community, a home group, a church, some sort of meditation group, some sort of fellowship, a group counseling that meets for an extended period of time. We need to be willing to go out eventually and ask somebody to mentor us. That the ism in sexaholism is I sponsor myself, so that we can move past the ism of the disease and move into the solution. We need to have a mentor. This isn't me. This is coming up with this. This is the 12 steps, and this is the 12-step lifestyle, and the transparency of learning how to get honest and learning how to talk about what's in our heads, and rather than keeping it in there, like talk about dog crap in the shade, how it stinks and smells and things live off it. And if you just take it and put it on the side of the road in the light, eventually the sun hits it and it dries up. So taking the secrets and the things that are inside of our hearts and our heads and being willing to share them with people. And you said the right people that you can trust, that you can take a risk with. And it's not just, you're not going to just share this stuff with, you know, the local guy working at 7-Eleven or somebody even at a church that wouldn't understand this process. So a good counselor or something. And just to go through this process over and over again, it just becomes lifestyle. Instead of looking into that other car when you're coming to work and looking for a lust hit, you're thinking about somebody else, praying on the phone with somebody, checking in. It just becomes... Life becomes more about how can I maximize my life and live it to the fullest, rather than how do I stay away from lust? How do I stay away from a drink? How do I stay away from it? It becomes less about the negative and becomes more about the positive. And I think even in your 15 minutes of sharing, you said that.
Well, absolutely, as well as, you know, one of the antidotes for somebody who was beginning to feel like he had slipped, he had been in treatment, he had gone to a treatment center, he was in a 12-step program, he had a great sponsor, he was in my therapy group, and for whatever reason, he was starting to dip again, and he couldn't figure out why, And I said, you know, I don't always think the why is so important. It's more important to figure out what is it you need to do to get out of that hole. And what he decided he was going to do was he was going to go back to Pine Grove, to Gentle Path, and be an alumni and talk about the program and talk about how far he had come. And that sense of service, as well as that reminder of how well he had done, was exactly what he needed to feel better. And to remind himself, it's not easy, but I've come a long way, and I'm in process.
It could be the biggest gift, because it sometimes lets us know as well that there's work to be done. There's some trauma that needs to be healed from a relapse. If we can look at, I know he didn't slip, but if we could look at these slips and take the shame out of them and say, there's a gift in here. I have a doctor in treatment right now who, it's a great thing that he relapsed back into his behavior, because he had so much trauma. And he was just getting by, and everyone thought he was the greatest guy in the world, and they still do, and his job is secure and everything, but this guy hated himself deep down. It was all about performance. It was all about achievement. And to come in for the last 90 days here and engage himself in a different way and to start to heal from the trauma from his youth. He had a horrible, he's from another country, and it was war in the country, in Afghanistan at the time, with Soviet occupation and just death everywhere. And to start to heal from these things it's beautiful. In a way, he'll look back at some point and say, good thing I started slipping, or I never would have dealt with these issues. I get excited.
Again, that's a gift, isn't it?
It's a gift.
Yeah.
I never went to treatment. Should have, but I didn't even. I wasn't even aware. I was in such a fog through the 80s. I really wasn't aware that was out there. I'm a huge believer in residential treatment. I did 2 weeks this year at the Bridge to Recovery in Santa Barbara. They also have a location in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and it's a place that you go and heal from codependency. What you think about me is how I think about me, and to start healing from all the ACA issues, the dysfunctional home and self-concept and that relationship with self, so doing the inner child work. But really, it's a trauma resolution place, and I go with a bunch of men every year to on-site outside of Nashville in Tennessee, and we do this 3-day, 4-day intense psychodrama, trauma therapy, but we do a bunch of rituals and Native American sweats, and we these 15 men, we absolutely love each other, and we do serious work. Like it's like going back to Pine Grove and going back into treatment. It's amazing. So that's what I would suggest too for people that need to take their recovery to the next step, where they're starting to backslide, is to reach out to a place where they could go on an intensive retreat or a 2-week sabbatical to just do that advanced recovery work. Or what you said was beautiful, you know, go on that mission trip or go on that trip back to and share your experience, strength, and hope so that you could light the fire again. It's you don't want to – I heard someone say this in an AA meeting in New York, and I've never forgot it. And I never heard anyone say it since other than me. And he said, don't let the good things that the 12-step recovery in God gives you take you away from 12-step recovery in God. And when our lives get really good and you're writing books and all these things are happening, don't let those things take you away from the meetings, from the sponsor, from everything that got you there. You know, the scariest thing I hear is when people say things like, yeah, it was great for me, and now, you know, that was, you know, it helped me back then. You know, I know this is semi-judgmental, but I hope I always need this recovery. I hope I always need a good therapist and a good sponsor and a home group, because, you know, it's important for me to remember that my thinking is the real issue. And when I get distorted thinking, if I don't go to these meetings and have these people in my life, I don't realize I have distorted thinking. So it's sort of like the crazy thing is you really don't realize you're crazy, and the important thing to go is to the 12-step meetings is, oh, I realize that I really need this, that my thinking isn't right. So that's that's preaching.
If I can, you know, you started out by talking about that legacy. Was that actually the legacy focus assignment?
Yes.
And obviously you said that is what spurred you to write the book, because clearly, you know, Patrick Carn says you need to work your recovery, and once you get it under your belt, you need to set goals that actualize yourself and your potential. And so that legacy focus assignment helped you to become real clear about how you could share your message even further. And truly, I've got to tell our listening audience, I am talking with Michael Dineen. He is an LCSW. He wrote The Gift of Fulfillment, Living the Principles of Healthy Recovery. And it's an amazing narrative story about his life and the life of others that he's worked with, in addition to coming up with what he believes are the principles of healthy recovery. And he started out tonight by talking about how he got to write this book. But truly, when you think about that assignment, can you apply it to the people that are listening right now that may be in recovery, may be thinking about recovery, may be struggling with recovery? How can they take their life to the next level?
In terms of the assignment?
Yep, in terms of the assignment.
Because I think the assignment gets us into reality, that we get to see that we have achieved certain things in our life, and we have to get honest. It's not false humility, and it's not grandiosity or ego to say, like, yeah, I got through this experience, or I graduated from this college, or whatever it is, the achievements, as well as the legacies, good and bad. We are leaving legacies. You know, we're going to leave a legacy of, you know, he died and he cheated. He cheated on his wives, and he was married several times, and he never really did get into recovery. And a lot of people were hurt because of that. If we passed on today, and then we get to take it to a whole new level where we get to say, okay, I have the gift of being alive, for things can change right now. I can make a decision in this moment that to live my life in a different way, to get the help that I need to get, so that when I'm on my deathbed — this is a beautiful meditation to do, it's separate from the legacy focus, but it's similar — is instead of imagining what do I need to do in the next week or the next month — I know this is going to sound a little bit contradictory to 12-step recovery, but to go all the way and think about when you're 80-something years old or 90-something years old, if you get that gift of living that long, look back on your life and think in terms of, you have whatever it is, you have your great-grandkids or your grandkids around you, and your spouse by your side, or your children, or good friends, or achievements that have happened, or colleagues that come to visit you, and you look back on your life, what is it like, and what got you there? What got you? How did you live your life that got you to this moment where you're deeply grateful for the life you've lived, and who you became, and the legacies that you've left behind, that you can die in peace? Then you can go all the way back to your present moment, and you say, how do I get there? You start living your way towards that. What's gonna get me to the point when I am gonna have peace in my heart? And so it's a nice way of that could be something someone does tonight, where they write down, this is how I want my life to go, and how, where my life should be when I'm dying. And then, okay, what's the next step? Well, the next step is you call and you reach out for help and get that counselor and take that next step, or get to that meeting, or write down the goals that you have, whatever. Get the coach that's going to guide you through that process. Something. It's always going to entail reaching out for help.
You know, Michael, we have, believe it or not, we're done with our time. I want to thank you because your enthusiasm and excitement for what this has brought to you and what it can bring to others is infectious. Again, if you're listening to the show, it's The Gift of Fulfillment, Michael Dineen. He wrote The Living the Principles of Healthy Recovery, and the book is The Gift of Fulfillment. Michael, thank you so much, and we are going to have to chat again.
Excellent. Sounds good. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. You have a great week. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye, Carol.
Bye. All right, everybody. I want you to live the life you deserve and fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll catch you next week for more sex help with Carol the Coach. Have a great week.